This is episode number 124 with Angel Martinez. Welcome to the School of Greatness. My name is Lewis Howes, former pro athlete turned lifestyle entrepreneur. And each week we bring you an inspiring person or message to help you discover how to unlock your inner greatness. Thanks for spending some time with me today. Now let the class begin. Thanks everyone for joining me today on the School of Greatness podcast. I'm very excited to introduce you to Angel Martinez. Now, for those that don't know who Angel is, he is the CEO of a billion-dollar company called Deckers, which owns a brand called UGG and runs multiple different shoe brands, but UGG being one of the most popular that most people would know. Now, I had an awesome interview with Angel a few months back, actually, at the headquarters of Deckers in Santa Barbara, California. And we covered a lot of different things, from his youth growing up in humble beginnings to what it's been like now, having a vision from a very young age to running a billion-dollar brand and being one of the leaders and a visionary in the shoe industry. We talk about how he early on took Reebok when it was just only $13 million in sales, took it to $300 million in sales a year and a half later. It's a very interesting story about how he took it there and the thing that catapulted that success. We cover a lot about his dreams growing up. We talk about how he keeps from getting comfortable once you've become so successful. I know a lot of entrepreneurs listening are achieving a lot of success, but how do you stay from getting too comfortable once you get there so that you can continue to grow? We also talk about his most valuable mentor growing up. And as a distance runner, he was a very successful distance runner. We talk about the principles from running into business and which ones really work in the business world as well. We also talk about how great leaders continue to have a huge vision and be successful when they go through an extremely emotional experience. And Angel went through one of those as an adult, and we talk about that and we dive into that as well. Very excited about this one. I think you guys are going to get a lot out of this. Make sure to stick around to the very end and check out all the show notes back at lewishowes.com/124. Without further ado, let's go ahead and dive into this episode with the one and only Angel Martinez.
Well, let's start off with, I'm really interested in, you know, your childhood. You kind of just talked about it right there, but you were born in Cuba, mm-hmm. correct? And then what happened? You were three when you left to the Bronx, mm-hmm. is that right? So your father shipped you away and sent you away to be with extended family, and mm-hmm. he stayed back, and your mother stayed back. Mm-hmm.
Your sister stayed back.
Mm-hmm. So you're the only one to leave. Mm-hmm. Why did they send you? And
well, because my father, I'd been living with my guardian from when I was 3 months old. Mm-hmm. My mother and father split up. He worked for the railroad. He was a conductor. So he was on the train 6 days a week up and down the country. Right. She just didn't want to be a mom anymore. So she just split. So my sister went to live with my grandmother, and I went to live with my grandmother's sister. And her kids, who were my parents' age, had been emigrating to the U.S. since 1952.
Okay.
And so by 1958, they wanted their parents with them, and my guardians, now I'd been with them since I was 3 months old, so my guardians said, well, yes, we'll go, but if he doesn't go, we don't go. Because they'd grown attached to me, you know, so... So that's how it happened. And my father agreed to their guardianship, and it was before the revolution. So in those days, the flight from Havana to New York City was $60.
Really?
So it wasn't a big deal. People would fly to Miami or fly to Havana from New York. Mm-hmm. You can go to Miami or Key West and take the ferry. And, so it wasn't, my father thought, well, he'll get an education in the U.S., which is what every Cuban wanted.
It was the dream, right?
Yeah, get high school education in the U.S. and then go back to Cuba to go to the university if you could get mm-hmm. in. Mm-hmm. And so it didn't work out that way because of the revolution.
Right. So what was it like growing up in the U.S. without, you know, with your extended family? And
it was tough when I was a kid because it was you know, being raised by grandparents, and he was disabled. And we didn't have a car or anything. So, and in New York, you know, didn't need a car. But it was one of those things that he couldn't play baseball with me or throw balls or anything, because he had had a bad motorcycle accident in '52. So I sort of took care of him, and then she was a little old lady. I mean, so it was just like taking care of your grandparents. When I was in high school, I really felt. Well, he passed away when I was a freshman. But when I was in high school, I really felt like I was taking care of her more than she was taking care of me.
How old was she when you were in high school?
80 something.
Yeah. So when you were a kid growing up, were there other kids around in the house, or was it just pretty much
well,
you?
We lived in a big apartment. So
big apartment in New York. So,
well, yeah, big, tenement type apartment.
Right.
So there were kids. It's New York, so there's kids everywhere.
But there was no family kids. It was just like...
My guardian's son lived in the same, but he had a son who's about my age, so we're still to this day. And then my other guardian's son lived there too, and he had a daughter a couple of years younger, so, there was a little
clan. Okay, cool. So you basically didn't grow up in the best of circumstances, though. You were on some government support and food stamps, I think. Right? So what was the dream for you growing up?
Well, I mean, my guardian was highly educated guy. He had come to, his name was Albert O'Neill, Irish-Cuban. So he had come to, in 1912, he came to live in Syracuse, New York, from Cuba, because his brother, who was 10 years older than him, sent for him, and he went to high school. He went between 12 and 17 years old. He lived in Syracuse, New York. Went to high school in Syracuse, graduated from high school, and spoke English flawlessly with no accent of any kind. With a name like Albert O'Neill, you wouldn't think he would have an accent, but the rest of the O'Neills in the family did. He was basically an engineer without the degree, I'd say. He worked for the U.S. Navy in the port of Havana during the war. Lots of stuff like that. But the most important thing was education to him.
Yeah.
So step one was, you need to take advantage of all of the educational opportunities. So that was ingrained in me early on. And I don't really remember ever needing to be told to do my homework or anything like that. I was always a very good student, for whatever reason.
So did you know you wanted to be in the shoe business? Or did you want to be an all-star athlete? Because I know you were a great runner.
Well, no, I wanted to play Major League Baseball.
Okay.
So was every Cuban kid. But when I was a freshman in high school, I think I was about 5'3 and 112 pounds. I couldn't hit the ball out of the infield.
Right.
And couldn't throw the ball out of the infield. I could field well, but that was about it. I could throw to first from second.
Right.
It was okay when we were playing Little League, but when we got to high school, it was a whole other thing. And I was just really small.
Yeah.
But PE class, I could run, and became kind of obvious after a little while that I had some, not in the very beginning, I was super slow in the beginning, but I wasn't going to quit, so I think I had a lot of tenacity for it. And by the end of my freshman year, I was running pretty well.
Yeah.
And that's kind of where it started.
You became a distance runner, right? Yes. Not as much a sprinter?
No, no.
What was your main event? What was your specialty?
The mile and 2 mile in high school.
What was your best time in the mile?
4:19.
Wow. And that's 1600, not the 1500.
That was a mile.
1600. Wow.
Yeah.
4:19.
Yeah.
My best, I was a decathlete in college, and my best was a 4:55, 1500.
But I ran 9:06 in the 2 mile.
Wow. That's moving. So and that was in high school. And then you went on to do college as well.
Yeah, I ran in college and, I ran the 5 and the 10,000 and cross country.
Wow.
I ended up running 4:09. Like I said, I wasn't a miler.
Yeah.
By the time I got to college, I wasn't a miler. There's some sub 4 minute miles.
Some freaks out there, yeah.
But I ran 4:09 in college and 8:53. But my strength was the longer distances, 5,000.
Because you could keep that up.
10,000, yeah.
Yeah.
So longer and road races and marathons and things.
Yeah. Did you ever have aspirations of being the Olympics or?
Oh yeah, yeah. When I was. I remember watching in 1968, Kip Kano and Jim Ryan in the mile in Mexico City.
Yeah.
And that race ended, and I cut off some slacks and put my sneakers on and went out for a run. I was so inspired. So it was, it was every kid who was a runner, their dream was to run in the Olympics.
Yeah.
But more than anything, after a while, you start to learn what running actually is.
Mm.
And it's that constant confrontation of a challenge every day.
Mm.
Some days you don't feel that good. Some days you feel great. Some days you're not inspired. Other days, you know, it's pouring rain and freezing cold and you still have to go run. And you, as a kid, that's an incredibly important lesson to learn, that it takes commitment.
Yeah.
You know, and you have to believe in yourself. And you can actually do whatever the hell you want. You know,
yeah.
There's no limit to what you can do. You in high school, I probably could have run faster looking back on it. But when I was in high school, it was doing everything it needed to do for me. You know, it was fulfilling for me.
What did it fulfill?
Well, I wanted to be an athlete. I always liked sports. I wanted to show to myself that I had what it took to be successful at sports. Yeah. And then the lesson of running is that it's about, you know, that's what you learn to be successful in life. All those lessons are, it's about more, it's not really about running.
Right.
So running was a metaphor for lots of things that you need to learn. And interesting, today you see that in high school, colleges love to recruit cross-country kids because they're always the kids that sail through college.
Mm.
They no issues. You know,
they're consistent on a long term.
Well, because they've trained themselves in their minds how to do that. I don't know if that's because that's the kid who comes to running in the first place, or if that or if running. I think it's a combination.
Mm.
But the cross country kids, and I coached cross country in Massachusetts after I retired from Reba for a few years, and the same thing. Those kids were, you know, we had no behavioral issues or motivational issues. They all wanted to be successful. What they lacked was confidence, and they lacked. Yeah. They need mentorship, and they need all the things that kids need. But if you point them in the right direction, that they're self-directed young people.
Mm.
And runners tend to be like that.
Yeah.
It's something about that sport and something about those personalities that come to that sport.
Sure. Very introspective, self-aware.
Yeah, self-directed, highly motivated. You can't get very far in the sport if you're not that.
No, you get, you know, be exhausted, you'll give up. Because
yeah,
who wants to run that far in the first place?
Right. I remember as when I first started running, several of the older guys on the team said, we only have one rule, you can't stop.
Wow.
That's it.
But you can go as slow as you want?
You can go as slow as you need to go, but you cannot stop.
Oh, wow.
No walking. There's no walking.
At least a jog.
No walking. And you can't. And then in a race, the rule was you can never drop out. That's the cardinal sin, is to drop out of a race. Even if... you know, you can't run any faster. You slow down, everybody's passing you. You have to finish.
Wow.
So those were actually pretty important rules that you learned.
Yeah.
I had those rules are still with me.
Wow.
No walking and you can't drop out.
Did you ever drop out of a race?
Never.
Never. Hmm.
Never.
Now, do you feel like, do you take that same principle and apply it to your businesses?
I don't do it in a conscious way, but it's a subliminal, subconscious orientation that I have. Yeah, that is how I approach it. I just approach life that way. It's not
sure.
Just business. It's just, this is just an extension of,
yeah,
of who you are. You know, if you have a shitty life, you're going to have a shitty business, frankly.
Yeah.
You know, if you don't understand what it takes to live a life with some integrity, you're not going to be successful in business. It really just starts with that.
Mm.
Doing what you say you're going to do, and, you know, driving yourself to a vision and goal that you may have, overcoming obstacles, treating people the way you'd like to be treated. You know, and people respect that, and I think that they aspire to work in that kind of an environment,
right,
where people are pretty straightforward. And so I try to emulate that here. That's what I'm about. So I don't tolerate deviation from that, because everybody can do that. It's like, don't drop out. I can say that to any bunch of runners, and it doesn't matter if you're talented or not talented. You can live by that rule.
Yeah.
Unless you have a physical injury, that's different.
Sure.
To give you an example, my son, Julian, who ran cross country, he's 24. He ran cross country for Claremont McKenna his senior year. And he'd always heard me drill this. And I'm not a drill sergeant, believe me, I'm not. But he'd always heard me say this. And senior year in college, his league meet, when he knew the team was depending on him, and he was like the number two or three man on the team, and it's a 5-mile cross country race, at the 2.5-mile mark, he felt this really sharp pain in his leg, in his shin area, lower leg. But he was not going to drop out. And he started slowing down. I could see something was wrong. And we're out there, Julian, what's the matter? And he was grimacing. And it turns out he finished the race and he had a broken leg.
Oh, my gosh.
He finished the race. He had fractured his leg at the 2.5 mile mark and still finished the race.
Wow.
And he couldn't even walk at the end. And the next, 2 hours later, he's in a cast. So
now, would you have advised him to drop out?
I would have said, Julian, you should have dropped out. And he goes, I don't drop out, Dad.
But he's like, you told me, Dad.
It wasn't even that. He said, no, I don't do that.
Wow.
He doesn't do that. I would have dropped out. I would have dropped out. So, these are the kind of kids, people there. And it's no surprise that they're, generally speaking, quite successful in business.
So what attracted you to distance running in the first place? Did they chose you?
I was like 5'3".
Right.
In distance running, there's no coach that's going to bench you. Right. There's no coach that tells you can't play. And then the clock never lies.
Mm.
There's no subjectivity.
Right. It's all the same playing field. Same race.
Exactly. Clock does not lie.
That's true.
And so that's what attracted me, is absolute. I could be as good as I wanted to be.
It was up to you.
It was up to me.
It wasn't up to the coach
who didn't like me.
Putting you in the game.
Exactly. And, doing me a favor and letting me play an inning.
Yeah.
No, none of that. So that's what attracted me to it. Just the idea that it's all up to me.
I like that. I like it. So what attracted you in the footwear business in the first place?
Well, that was a natural extension of loving running. I mean, when I got in, I graduated from high school in 73. And at that time, there's a startup company in Oregon called Nike. And it really wasn't even called Nike. It was called Blue Ribbon Sports. And we were buying shoes from Blue Ribbon Sports in Berkeley in some guy's basement.
Really?
And the shoes they sold were Onitsuka Tiger. They were these shoes from Japan.
Mm-hmm.
But there were no other running shoes except Onitsuka Tiger back then. So we wanted running shoes. So we'd go to Berkeley and we'd buy the shoes. And the distributor called BRS, Blue Ribbon Sports, was Phil Knight. And they were importing those shoes from Japan.
Mm.
And that later became Nike when basically they absconded with Onitsuka Tiger's patents, patterns and names of product and just relabeled it all Nike.
Right.
which is interesting. People don't talk about that, but that was fact. And by the time I was in college and graduating in 77, the running boom had happened or was happening. And I saw people that I had known making a living from running. And I was a rhetoric major. So I was always good at logic and business and the logic of business. And I can do basic arithmetic really well.
Mm-hmm.
Don't ask me to do calculus. it doesn't, I got through 2 years of calculus in college, but I haven't used it since.
Sure.
Business math is arithmetic. Pluses and minuses is pretty much it. You could argue that it's different now with IT, et cetera, but I'll persist in that opinion. And so when I saw these people making a living from it, I thought, why not me? I could, I can make a living from my passion, which is what everybody would want to do. And so I wanted to open a running shoe store. I was well known in the Bay Area, San Francisco Bay Area, for running and racing, and I won a lot of races, a pretty well-known runner. So people...
Was this college or after college?
After college.
Okay. So you were like semi-professional then, or what?
Yeah.
Amateur?
But you couldn't be professional.
It was just like amateur.
If you got caught taking any money or any payment, you would be, quote, banned for life.
Gotcha. Okay.
There was a thing called the AAU.
Gotcha.
The Athletic Union. And there's a bunch of old men. Mm-hmm. I'm talking old men. These are 70, 80-year-old guys who maybe ran a race in 1923, and then they joined the AAU to protect the integrity of amateurism.
Right.
So it was the foundation of how the Olympics were. It was total nonsense even then.
Right.
But because you can't be an athlete and devote all that time and
not get paid
and not get at least remunerated for showing up.
Right. Yeah.
If you want to compete in a race somewhere across the country and you don't have a job, or you have a part-time job because you need to train, how are you going to afford a plane ticket to do that?
Yeah.
So we were getting paid under the table as expenses on occasion.
Sure. Travel or whatever, yeah.
Yeah, people would occasionally, you'd get like a ticket to a meet, and they'd send you a first-class ticket, and you could cash it in for a coach ticket and keep the difference.
Right.
Or you'd get hotel stipend, and you'd pack six guys in a room, and you'd split the money that they gave you. So... that was just the way you had to do it.
Right.
And so, yeah. So after college, I went to work for a department store chain called Carter Holly Hale. I used to own Neiman Marcus and Emporium Capwell's up in the Bay Area, some other stores.
One of my favorite parts about my job is that I get the opportunity to travel a lot. And in fact, I'm recording this right now while I'm in Mexico. And actually, I was thinking about something that I wanted to share because I get a lot of questions from so many people about different side hustle ideas. So here's one for those of you out there that are on the go a lot like I am or traveling a lot. When you're staying in your Airbnb on your trips, have you ever thought about how you could be making extra money by hosting through Airbnb while your home is vacant? If you're interested in an extra stream of income, Airbnb hosting is an easy place to start, and it's like giving your home some company while you're away. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
And so I learned retail. I was there for about 18 months or something like that. And my goal there was to learn basic retail methodology. And then I left that job and went to work for Runner's World magazine to run the store that they were opening in Mountain View.
And this was one of the first kind of running stores.
This was
stores.
Actually the first running shoe specialty store on the West Coast. I'd say it was the most advanced running shoe specialty store on the West Coast. There was one more in Gainesville, Florida, called Fidipides. That was owned by a famous runner. But we had Starting Line Sports, which was owned by Runner's World. And then after a year or two, I struck a deal with them to buy half the store. They decided they didn't want to be in retail. We had a mail order business too. And then about a little after that, I opened a second store in Alameda, which I own outright. So I had those two stores and I was running, still racing, still training. I had stores were open 7 days a week. I had a running club. We had a running club with like 300 people in it. We had a big road race we put on, still going on in Alameda. And, it was pretty intense. I mean, talk about burning the candle at both ends. I mean, the racing went out the window because I didn't have time to train. And then I took a job. These two guys came in my store one day. One of them was quite heavy, and the other one was a chain smoker. And it was obvious that neither of them had ever run a step in their lives. And they're selling this brand of shoe from England called Reebok. And I knew Reebok because I had a pair in high school, and I'd ordered them from England.
It was a small company then.
It was a tiny company. They made handmade shoes for the high-end elite British athletes.
So it's about $2 million a year in business or less.
Yeah, tiny. Small. I mean, I'd be surprised if they did $2 million. I mean, right. It was really small.
Sure.
But it was a super geek brand, you know. Yeah. And the only people knew about Reebok. They were famous for their shoes being ridiculously light. There was nothing to them. Talk about minimalist. These were the original minimalist shoes. And they were made of kangaroo leather and... They were cool looking, and the track spikes were pretty cool looking. But only the top level people had them. So if you had a pair of those, you better be running fast.
Sure.
So anyway, these guys came in the store. They were selling Reebok. They had just acquired distribution in the U.S. for Reebok, and they didn't know anything about it. They knew nothing about running. They really didn't know what the hell they were talking about.
Wow.
So one thing led to another, and I ended up becoming the sales rep for Northern California, Oregon, and Washington. Because what prompted me to do that was I remember seeing all the reps that used to come in to call on me. They were all driving BMWs. They didn't seem to work. All they did was take me to lunch. And they were home by 3. And I kept thinking, you know, what am I doing wrong? I'm obviously on the wrong side of the wall here.
Right. Working all day, all night.
Yeah. And so I thought, I think I'd rather get on that side, figure that out. So the opportunity came up, and I had two store managers that I hired to run the stores, and then I went on the road selling Reebok in Nike's backyard, actually.
Right, so. Right. And then there's a famous story about how you kind of were a champion for the aerobic shoe.
Right, I did that shoe. Yeah.
And that's kind of what took Reebok from whatever, a few million or nothing, to kind of like a few hundreds of millions, right, basically?
Right, yeah, we... pretty much went from $13 million to $300 million in a year and a half.
Wow. Because of this one shoe.
Pretty much, yeah.
And so how did this come about? I think it was a story about with your wife was taking
Yeah, my
classes.
Wife was taking aerobics, and I was on the road 3 weeks every month and home 1 week, which is horrible because we just got married.
Yeah.
Not good. So whenever I was home, I wanted to do aerobics and do whatever she was doing. So I noticed all the women in the aerobics class were barefoot on either carpeted floors or concrete or wood. And some of them were wearing big, bulky looking running shoes. So, and I also noticed that if on Monday the instructor was wearing a pink headband, by Wednesday everybody was wearing a pink headband.
Interesting.
So it occurred to me that two things. Number one, that we needed a shoe for aerobics. And I knew exactly what it needed to look like because I had a pair of track spikes at home that had a very, they were kangaroo leather. They had an open toe box and white. And they almost, they looked kind of like a jazz dance shoe, Capizio, which is a shoe that was famous back then. And so I thought, that's the shoe. Now we just need to make that into a sort of a court shoe.
More comfortable. And
add a little cushioning.
You know?
And so that's what we did.
So how did you make it happen? Did you talk to the CEO and say, let's...
Yeah, yeah. And I called him up, said, I want to do an aerobics shoe. And he said, what's aerobics? He wasn't in the, exactly in the thick of fitness.
Right.
And so then I, there was another guy who worked for the company who was in charge of development and, you know, product. So he and I got together. I brought him the half of the half pair of my track spikes, which I never got back. And I drew it on a napkin. I said, look, it's got to look like this. It's got to have this open toe. You know, it's got to have some cushioning and some foxing like this particular racquetball shoe. Racquetball was big back then. So racquetball shoes had some foxing in the heel and the toe area.
Okay.
And so I said, this is what, but the most important, it's got to look like a jazz shoe. It's got to look super soft. I wanted to use kangaroo leather, but at the time, kangaroos were an endangered species, which is hard to believe now because they're eating half of Australia. But at the time, you couldn't import kangaroo leather to the U.S. And all of the best shoes in the world for performance were kangaroo. You know, all, even to this day, all the best soccer shoes that you see the soccer players at a world-class level are all wearing kangaroo shoes.
Really?
Because kangaroo is incredibly thin, very, very light, and super strong.
Yeah.
And when it's exposed to water, it doesn't dry up. Mm. So it actually just forms to your toes. So what a soccer player does is you buy the shoes a half size or a size too small.
And then you kind of mold
it. You get them wet, leave them on your feet, and when they dry, you have a shoe that's formed to your foot.
Perfect.
You can feel the ball because they're so light. I mean, the leather's so thin and super strong. But same is true with track spikes. So all these old Adidas sprint spikes were kangaroo.
Interesting. So you worked with this guy. On the CEO kind of laughed at you.
Yeah, he didn't think there was much to that.
And then you worked with the development, product developer guy.
Yeah.
And so you just worked with him behind the CEO's back?
Yes.
Or did he know about
pretty
it?
Pretty much, yeah, behind his back.
Wow, okay.
Well, we were, you know, look, I remember stopping after one of my trips and calling him up from a place up on I-5 in those days, stopping a payphone call back to Boston. I was pissed because I just spent 3 weeks on the road and lost $130, you know, and I'd been eating at McDonald's and not training and sleeping in Motel 6, and I lost $130. And the reason for it was that I people were canceling orders because the running shoe boom was plateauing. And so we were not in the top five brands in any store. And, you know, retailers are saying, well, I got to cut back to five brands for running shoes, and you're not in them. So I don't care how nice a guy you are. I don't care how good you run. Yes, when you come into town, we run together. You take us to lunch, blah, blah, blah.
People aren't buying them.
But business is business. And you guys are not, even though we had a Runner's World 5-star rating and all that stuff you needed at the time, it just wasn't happening. So, and this, and if I couldn't do it, no rep in the country is going to do it. Because I was able to talk to running stores coming from running. So I knew we were in trouble. So, you know. I said that, so when I talked to the product guy, I said, look, man, I'm not going to be getting paid much longer anyway. So what's the difference?
Right.
I'm either going to lose my job because I quit or I'm going to lose my job because I get fired. But either way, I'm not getting paid. So we got to figure out something. And let's take a shot. I want to take a shot at this aerobics thing because the other important point, besides the fact that, you know, aerobics was all women, who buys shoes?
Women.
Women buy... I came across this little knit nugget.
Tons of shoes.
I came across a little nugget back then because I was doing a little research in the library. And the nugget was that women bought 8 times as much footwear as men at the time. 8 times. That's true. That's true. And I wouldn't be surprised if the ratio is about the same today. And if it's not the same, it's only tailed off because of athletic footwear. Because back then, most guys had one pair of Jack Purcells or Chuck Taylors, and that was it for their athletic footwear.
Wow.
And women had, and to this day, they buy outfits. They buy color. They buy season. Guys buy a pair of shoes, and wear them until they can't wear them anymore.
Yeah.
And that's still true.
Yeah.
Right? So if you're in the shoe business and you're not selling shoes to women, you got a big problem.
Mm.
And I don't already known that because Reebok, we were doing a good job selling women's shoes, women's running shoes, only because we put some color into them, really. And so the fact one was that, you know, women were doing aerobics. The instructor was super influential because of the pink headband thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so I said to this guy, and I said, look, what I'm going to do, you just get me some shoes.
Wow.
Give me a couple hundred pair of shoes. I'm going to put them on the instructors. And it's an aerobic shoe, the first of its kind, and we'll see what happens.
Wow.
And that's what I did. In the meantime, I created a program. I'd shown the sample around to women and instructors. And I'd said, look, this is an aerobic shoe. Here's why it's an aerobic shoe. They didn't even hear a word I was saying because they loved the shoe. It was so cute.
Wow, there's like
it made your feet look small, sure. Look great with outfits, and it came in a bunch of colors.
Right, that's all I care about.
And so, well, it isn't that people were superficial. It's just that women have a different perspective for buying footwear. Sure. It needs to match up.
It doesn't need to be
the outfit. You needed to make pink aerobic shoes to match the pink leotards.
Right.
Or dark or light blue aerobic shoes to match the light blue leotard. So we made shoes that match a color of the clothes. It was not brain surgery, you know, but it was a revolutionary thing in the athletic world because back then women, this is pre-Title IX, so women were not supposed to sweat.
Right.
It was not considered feminine to sweat in public.
Mm.
The other thing that was not considered good was muscles on women was considered butch.
Yeah.
This is all before you were born, probably. Right. So women were not supposed to have muscles.
Yeah.
You look all dykey. Pardon my French, you know.
Sure.
That's what people were saying.
Right.
And I remember when Jane Fonda, you know, came out with the Jane Fonda workout, and Jane had guns. She had biceps. She had deltoids, and women were saying, "I don't like that. That looks so. She looks so butch."
Mm.
Well, little do you know that, you know, now years later, that's considered as feminine as anything. And but back, this is 1980, and that wasn't the case.
Yeah.
So, you know, effectively, I saw an opportunity to kill all those birds with one stone, you know, introduce a product line that women wanted to buy because women were buying the majority of footwear. And I knew that if we gave them athletic footwear, they would be buying the majority of athletic footwear.
Mm.
And there was an emerging opportunity to create a movement among women that was already starting. And Jackie Sorensen, who was an aerobics person, Jane Fonda, and a few others were starting this thing. And it was really about women discovering the power of physical activity and how it influenced your self-awareness and your feeling of power, if you will, you know. So no different than running had for me. So I thought for me, aerobics was about much more than aerobics, and it was about much more than selling shoes. Aerobics was a vehicle for women to discover the power that they could get through physical activity and what that does for you, the confidence it builds in you.
Right.
It's not just physical strength, it gives you emotional strength, you know, because I knew that because I had done that for me.
For running?
From running.
Yeah.
And so I figured, you know, and I saw it happening. Women were really getting into it. Mm. And this was an environment where they could be themselves and not worry about what men thought and have a lot of fun and get stronger. And you could see people transform.
Mm.
They'd lose 40 pounds. Suddenly they were strong and fit, and then they started running. All that stuff happened because of what we did with aerobics, what we contributed to very greatly. And that was the purpose of doing it, to tell you the truth. That really was the purpose of it. Wow. That was Reebok. That was the purpose of Reebok.
To empower women.
Right. Through physical activity.
Wow.
That was the purpose of Reebok. Until we stopped letting that be our purpose, Reebok was bigger than Nike.
Wow.
Reebok, we went blowing past Nike in about 1984, 85. Suddenly we went past about $600 million.
Wow.
They didn't know what hit them. They didn't understand.
You were like $10 million 4 or 5 years before that.
3 years.
Wow.
Yeah.
So it
was the fastest growing company in the history of American business until Microsoft came along. Reebok was the fastest growing company in the history of American business.
Because of this one shoe idea you had.
Pretty much.
Wow.
Yeah, that was it. Yeah, we did some other shoes too. But
that was the most successful shoe.
Well, it was what launched the company.
Sure.
You know? But but people don't understand. It was never about aerobics. It was never about shoes. So it was about power.
Mm.
You know, that idea of feeling empowered.
Sure. Wow. Who's your most valuable mentor growing up? And what lesson was the big lesson that they taught you?
Well, my guardian, Albert O'Neill, was probably the number one. Just he was very very smart. He was a very smart man, very practical. What he always said to me is, don't be a fool. He always said that, don't be a fool. What he meant by that was, know what you're talking about. You know, at least study things.
Right.
Don't be taken down a path by people who don't know what they're talking
about. Right.
So, and then I had, I'd say my high school coach was pretty important for me. Almost, he was there for me after my guardian passed away. So he was a bit of a father figure. I used to go, he used to let me go hang out at his house, have dinner over there, and, you know, just kind of be around his family. I had a little crush on his daughter, too, by the way. He's pretty much my age. But the point is that he was really a great guy in that respect.
What's the biggest lesson you learned from him?
That you don't, you know, he was a super soft-spoken guy. Like when you'd be at a track meet and you hear everything that's going on, people are yelling. And and I could always spot his voice because he'd never yelled. He would just say, oh, yeah, go, Angelo, just about like that. I could always hear his voice. But he was that kind of a person. Uh-huh. So, you know, he didn't need to be loud to get his point across and get people to perform. And I just watching that, I think I'm a lot that way. I don't yell at people. I don't lose it with people. Never have. But I do get from people what I need them to do.
Sure. You know?
And
how do you do that?
Try to just, first of all, make sure they understand why. Why we're doing something. If you understand why you have to do something, then it's easier to do it.
Right.
If I don't understand why I'm doing something, then what I have is the military. You know, I just point to a hill, say, you know, we're going over there, all those machines, we're going.
Right.
Nobody says why.
Right.
I'd be a horribly bad, you know, soldier. Because I would always ask, well, why are we doing that?
Right.
That's stupid. Or, I'm not a fool. Yeah, I'm going to run over there and get shot? Isn't there a better way to do this?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I'd really make a terrible soldier.
I feel like, you know, let's talk more about Reebok. Because you took that company, it was the biggest shoe company in the world, or the biggest athletic shoe company?
It was bigger than, for a little while, we were the biggest athletic brand. We weren't bigger than Adidas. Adidas was globally the powerhouse.
Yeah.
But we were bigger than Nike, and we blew by them like they were standing still. It was very much akin to what happens in a race, you know, where you're the unknown.
Sure.
And the champion's out there prancing around, and you just go blowing past him on the bell lap, and he doesn't know what hit him.
Wow.
And that's what happened. And it was actually really fun to do that.
Wow.
Because Nike wasn't known for their humility.
So how long were you with Reebok?
21 years.
21 years.
Yeah.
And why did you end up leaving, or what happened?
Well, I mean, I was really exhausted by it all. Secondly, Reebok lost its way. You know, I mean, we had too many changes in direction, too many presidents that were brought in. The only reason I was there that long was I was always operating in sort of the exile environment. You know, I mean, I was in Southern California for 9 years running the business development center, which I started. And then for 5 years, I ran the Rockport company, which was 45 miles away from Reebok corporate headquarters. And they left me alone and I could run my business.
Wasn't that business going down, and then they brought you in to be
the Rockport
president?
Company.
Yeah, the Rockport.
Yeah, and you doubled it. I doubled it. We doubled it in 4 years. We doubled it. Almost doubled it. No, we did double it. And I didn't do any. You know, I mean, I didn't know anything about the quote unquote brown shoe business. I know about shoes. I know about selling shoes. I know about that. But the making of a brown shoe is very different than making athletic shoes, especially then. So that was an education for me because we had so many incredibly talented shoemakers at Rockport. We never talked about shoemakers at Reebok. Shoemakers were athletic shoes. I don't know. It's one basically one construction. A lot of the shoes weren't even using leather. You were using nylon materials, so you don't get the leather craft involved. And, the laths are a little more forgiving, and on and on. So when I got to Rockport and discovered shoemaking, and really learned about shoemaking, and got involved in that, it opened up a lot of insight for me. You know. So we combined some of the marketing tactics and line-building tactics from the athletic world with the celebration of the shoemaking from the Rockport world. The best of both worlds came together. We were over, you know, double the size of Rockport.
Wow. And then Stuart told me a story about you starting another company. I can't remember if it was during Reebok but it was like a kind of like a Fathead product.
Yeah, it was stickers. It was Fathead before there was ever Fathead.
Right, right. And then you sold that to M3, right?
3M, yeah.
3M. Mm-hmm. So why did you come up with that idea? What was
just because we wanted to decorate my son's room. And, really? I thought it would be cool to do this border motif. It was cars. He loved cars. So we did, the border was like a street with a center line and mailboxes and stop signs, street lights. And then the cars, they were all made from contact paper, you know, colored paper, vinyl, mm-hmm. and he could move them around, you know. So we thought that was cute. So I did that. And then it occurred to me once I did it that this is an idea that if we had an adhesive that would come off the wall, like Post-it, mm-hmm. that it would work as a room decor system.
To put on, take off, move around, right. Put in a different room.
Put it on your furniture.
Sure.
And, you know, kids like to do that. They like to put stuff
right.
on walls.
Right, right.
And this, you could put it on your furniture. And it was no big deal. Parents just come over and peel it off, put it somewhere else. It left no residue. It was Post-it notepads for the wall, basically. Yeah. So I got a patent on it, and then we went. And I developed it with my wife. She was the president, actually.
Wow.
And we built it up a little bit, had a group that we hired to help us manage it. And then we sold it to 3M.
Which is, they own Scotch tape and everything, right?
They invented Post-it notepads. Post-it notes. So I had they didn't have, this is crazy, I think this is where they realized, because I named it, the company was called Decorate It.
Nice.
And they didn't realize their trademark protection didn't extend to anything besides Post-it. So I just said to them, you know, sorry you didn't have that protected, but I went and got it. So they ended up kind of being a little bit impressed by that. Without little guy comes along. It was a $13 billion company at the time.
Wow.
And so then we ended up striking a deal, and they bought the brand. And it is now, that same technology is now Fathead.
No way.
Yeah.
Wow.
Fathead is probably the same patent. The patent expired now.
Okay.
But the Fathead patent is my patent. I don't even think Fathead has a patent anymore. My patent was Fathead.
Wow.
Because we had also done, I licensed NFL. We had licensed Disney. You know, we had licensed NASCAR. Mm-hmm. I had all those. Those were all
same thing as Fathead.
Decorated.
Yeah.
Yeah. And yeah, I had all the NFL team helmets that you could use in a room. And then the border was a gridiron.
Wow. That's cool. What year was this?
So Adrian, my oldest, I was 86, 87.
Yeah. Okay. That's cool. So let's talk about challenges and crises. I think that every big leader goes through lots of different challenges because they have to overcome them in order to stand out from the crowd. What are some big challenges or things that you've gone through either personally or in business that really kind of shaped who you are as a person?
Well, I mean, there's always a challenge if you don't see yourself as a conventional person, or in other words, you don't really want to march down the same path as other people do in a lockstep fashion, then you're making harder on yourself.
Yeah.
You know, so that's a challenge, you know. And I didn't willingly want to make it harder on myself, but I was also unwilling to go down that lockstep path. So you know, it just created, there were more hills to climb.
Yeah.
But I was a good hill runner, you know, so the hills didn't bother me.
Yeah.
And but that was an issue. You know, then the other issue was just the idea of just being able to project yourself into a future that you had no reference point for, you know? So like if you grow up in a well-to-do middle class, solidly middle class family, where every few years you get a new car, you know, you live in a nice house, you take a nice vacation every once in a while. I'm not talking about anything exotic. I'm talking about the middle class American dream, right?
Sure.
For me growing up, that was absolute fantasy land. Mm. That was something I saw on TV, you know. I saw that on Leave It to Beaver.
Yeah.
And that was like, that house on TV was the nicest. It was like a palace to me. So it's a challenge to actually convince yourself that you belong there too.
Mm.
That why, how come, what's keeping you from projecting yourself into that? So I came up with something that years and years ago, when I was a kid, I'll never forget this either, because I was playing with a telescope, you know, and And I looked at, and I realized, like kids all do, you look through both ends and you say, wow, this looks totally different. When I turn the telescope around, it looks totally different.
Right.
And, you know, and I remember we would make a joke about somebody not knowing which end of the telescope to look through, you know. And my guardian would actually say that. And one of the things that I've always said is, you know, you should look through the other end of the telescope.
Mm.
And by that, I mean, you know, you just might be looking at your life through the wrong end of the telescope. You might, to you, in that view, things might seem very, very far away. But if you just turn it around, you realize that's not true, you know. So what I really sort of came to was this idea that it's easier to come from a place and go to a place. And by that, I mean, to give you an example, when I was a kid, the school record in the mile in high school was 4:22. And broken by a very talented runner in 1967. So it wasn't really that long before me, but it was considered a record that wouldn't be broken.
Sure.
Because back then we didn't have a track. And the tracks we ran on...
Cinder track, right?
No, we didn't have a track.
Wow.
We used to run around the goalposts at the football
just on the grass. Field.
Yeah. And and every track we went to compete on was a cinder track, maybe. Those were the good tracks. Most of them were dirt tracks,
right,
with rocks on them and rutted in the fast lane. So they weren't conducive to running fast. So a 4:22 was considered, wow, you know, that was really a fast time. Then there was Jim Ryan, who was a god. That was a whole other thing. But, you know, so I remember thinking to myself, I wonder what this guy does every morning that I don't do. I wonder where he eats. I wonder how much he sleeps. I wonder, you know, and so then I started, as I got more into running, I started observing, you know, all these other really good runners that were not high school runners, they were older. And I said, why can't I be that guy? So why don't I just decide I am that guy? I'll immediately overnight become that guy.
Mm.
And then I'll just project back on where I am from there. So in other words, let's say that you want to be, my goal at the time was also to break 9 minutes for 2 miles in high school, which was really super fast. So then I said, well, what would a 9 minute, 2 miler, how do they train? You know, what do they eat? How do they behave? You know, how do they act? How do they view life?
Right.
And so I decided I'm already a 9 minute, 2 miler. I just haven't run 9 minutes yet, but I'm a 9 minute, 2 mile. And I just started looking at it that way. And, you know, you become what you envision yourself being.
Right.
And that's been the way that I've always managed my whole life since then. Reebok, it wasn't to me a surprise that we went blowing past Nike. I thought we were better than Nike.
Wow.
We just hadn't done it yet. You know, right. Deckers, I thought this was, this building that we're in, I knew this. I saw this. I didn't come to Deckers because I wanted to stay in this funky place we were at. I had a bigger, I was already in the other end of the telescope for this company. You know, I saw this as a multi-billion-dollar company because of the quality of the people and the products and the brands.
And you came in when it was around a few hundred
200 million.
$200 million. And that's 1.6. I think Forbes has it wrong right now. I think that's 1.4.
That was last year. Yeah. That was 2 years ago. No.
So you've been here for 6 or 7 years now?
No, I've been here 9 years.
9 years. So from, yeah, that's pretty good. Grown at over a billion.
Billion four. Billion four.
That's pretty good. Yeah. That's not bad. Wall Street must love you.
No, they don't. No, Wall Street doesn't love anybody. They love Wall Street. That's all
right,
they
have. Right. For those listening, we're sitting in a brand new, you know, space, huge, I don't know what you call this place, foundation or headquarters that it used to be on the other side of Santa Barbara, but it's this beautiful space right now. So congrats. It's amazing here. What about, you know, I know you've been through some personal, you know, some really hard personal experiences with family. And what I'm curious is, how does a great leader continue to have a huge vision and be successful when they go through an emotional experience or, you know, an extremely, you know, emotional experience as the one that you had? And how does someone continue being a positive force in the world, being of service, you know, giving back the way you do, and, you know.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's, first of all, it was my son, what you're referring to is my son passing away, our oldest. And Adrian was a wonderful person. He was people talk about, oh, he's an old soul. This kid, I distinctly had the feeling that he was my dad in a previous life or something, even when he was a little tyke. And he was just one of those people that everyone was attracted to. He never said a bad thing about anybody. I never, ever, ever remember him.
Wow.
He never lied, not once, ever. Which isn't little white lies from little kids you hear all the time. Never, not once. Wow. Just one of those. He was a beautiful person.
Mm-hmm.
And when this happened, I mean, I think we realized that the what we really need to do is to honor him and everything he was about and everything he stood for the rest of our lives.
Mm-hmm.
Because he was an example for us and everyone he met. For how to live your life and how to be in the world. And so we became, as a family, I think, even more focused on living a quality life like he did. And so, because it was never about him, you know. See, the thing about him, Adrian was the type of person that had a gift for math. He was a gifted math mind. And so he never had to study. He graduated from degree at Williams College. He had a math degree. He just graduated. And he never needed to study math, ever. People would be shocked that he would, you know, these are high-level math courses, and he would just show up, take the test, get an A, and walk out. So what would he do in all the time he wasn't studying? He would go around to all of his math major friends and help them with their work.
Yeah.
Until they understood or they got it. Or if somebody was really stressed out, he'd take them bowling or he'd take them to go find a burrito somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
No consideration for anything other than trying to help somebody who needed help.
Yeah.
And but that's the kind of person he was, you know. So we really became much more aware of that. We got to look through that end of his telescope, you know, and really kind of understand that it's not about us, it's not about me. This is not about... Deckers is about all of these people that work here and all the people that work for the company around the world having the kind of opportunity that I had. To live a life that maybe is outside of your expectations or your practical reality or your you can dream about it, but you don't have the vehicle.
Right.
Here's the vehicle. And I really feel that reflects itself in the products we make and how much success we have, because I don't believe we're a greedy organization. You know, I think in my mind, greed is probably the single thing, biggest problem we have as a society and a culture, is that this infusion of greed in just about every aspect of life, particularly in how we operate our business and how we operate our government.
Right.
Yeah. And I think I'm pretty proud of the fact we're not a greedy organization.
Yeah. You
know, we're here to serve our consumers, number one. Then we're here to serve our employees, because without the great employees, we can't serve our consumers.
Mm-hmm.
Then we're here to serve our shareholders, number three. Because without great employees and great consumers, we won't have any shareholders.
Right.
It's pretty logical. And I've had pushback from people telling me, well, you know, you should have shareholders' interests first. No, I'm sorry, I vehemently disagree with that.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Shareholder interest comes third, behind the other two, which are more important. So if you have happy consumers who love everything you do,
right,
shareholders are going to be happy. If you have great employees who can deliver against what consumers need, shareholders are going to be happy.
Right.
If you have happy shareholders first, you may not have the other two.
Right. Yeah, interesting.
I could make a lot of decisions that would make shareholders very, very happy in the short term, but destroy this company in the longer term.
Sure. So, what's the biggest challenge as a leader to stay at the top when everything you touch seems to, you know, double, triple, quadruple? How do you not stay comfortable, or how do you not get in this comfort zone where that allows you to continue to grow with each thing that you get into?
Because it's the process is what's important.
Mm.
It's not the product. It's not the end. How do you know that you're at the end game of anything? You know, the whole idea is, in my mind, is just have a good process for living your life. Just live your life, you know. Learn, and do things that are consistent with what you've learned.
Right.
and strive to do them better all the time, every day, until you can't walk around, until you're done, you know? And you should make progress every day against increasingly clear goals that may in the beginning be about economic realities. You want to buy a house, you want to buy a car, you want to take a vacation, you want to educate your kids. But over time, if you keep going down that path, become about things that are bigger than you. You've handled some of those things.
Basic needs.
Or you've put them in some perspective.
Sure.
And now you're on to what do other people need? Right. And then the more you give away, the more you get back, which is the crazy thing. That's the craziest thing of all.
Yeah. And you're a big believer in giving back in the community. I think you have a program with all of your employees, right? You match up to $1,000.
A couple thousand dollars.
The company will match to any of their charity
that
they want to. That's inspiring. Why do you do that?
Why not? It's the right thing to do.
Right.
People, because I want to inspire in people this idea that the more you give, the more you're going to get back.
Mm.
You know, so we have, the other thing we do is we have a competition among all of our departments for who's going to donate the most number of hours to charities in a year.
No.
So like 2 years ago, we were, the 3 years ago, I think it was, the total number of hours that our employees donated to local charities was 4,500 hours. I think last year it was over 10,000.
Wow.
And I require all of the people on the executive leadership team to be on a
advisory board, right?
A local charitable board.
That's
if
cool.
They can, you know, because they have a lot to offer and these boards need them.
Right.
So we try to do that, you know.
And so when did you first learn this lesson of the more you give, the more you get back? Did that just come to you one day, or did someone teach you that, or did you experience it?
You know, we all are taught this when we're growing up, whatever religion you're in or whatever, you know, you're sort of, you see movies and the fables and the this and the that, and yet we sort of turn a blind eye to it for whatever reason, because I think we get greedy, because we want it for ourselves, right?
Yeah.
So it's normal.
Sure.
But I don't know what happened. It happened when I was reflecting on the fact that when I was a kid and we didn't have anything and we had to have, you know, I was a little kid. So I was, what could I do?
Right.
So we needed food stamps and we needed, in New York City, they used to give away these big cheese blocks and these giant tins of peanut butter. And you went and got in line for those things. And you know what? We needed that.
Right.
And I remember as a kid saying, you know, I hate this. I hate that we have to take this. And I remember saying to myself very clearly, I'm going to pay this back someday. Wow. So, you know, I pay a lot of taxes, so I've paid it back many times. but the thing that really distressed me a little bit is when people say that all of these people are freeloading on the system and that they're takers. And that they're the makers, and then they're the takers. Well, what about the givers? Where are they in the mix? Let's just stop talking about that and start saying, well, why not have some more givers here? And you won't have to worry about takers, and the makers will make more, you know? So it's just a ridiculous conversation. So I've become very adamant about this, almost militant about it.
So what do you recommend for people who are listening, maybe who are, you know, have a job or entrepreneurs, that either they're just getting by or maybe they're making a decent salary to, you know, have a vacation every year or something like that, or maybe they got a little extra cash. What do you recommend and how to give? Is it through time? Is it through donations? Is it through...
You know, most people have time.
Yeah.
Time is the most precious commodity if you're running a charity.
Mm-hmm.
You need help.
Yeah.
You need people to volunteer their time, whether it's a Boys and Girls Club where you can coach basketball, or take kids out on a field trip to the Natural History Museum, or, you know, you can have a cooking class for the kids. You know, kids need that. And a lot of the problem you have in so many communities is that you have parents who have to work two or three jobs just to put food on the table. So what happens to kids? The kids are left on their own to wander around the neighborhood and get influenced by all kinds of people.
Right.
Do all kinds of stuff they shouldn't be doing. And, you know, a few adults every once in a while just say, hey, I care about you.
Yeah.
How'd you like to cook spaghetti?
Right.
You know?
It'd be great. It does a lot for kids.
It isn't about what you're doing with them. It's that you're doing something with them.
Yeah.
And, you know, that That's what's important. So time, people say, well, I don't have any money. I can't get. Well, actually, do you have, how about 2 hours a week? You flitter away 2 hours a week watching some stupid thing on TV.
Right.
You can always DVR that.
Right.
And, you know, go, I'm not trying to be holier than thou or anything. I'm just saying that people need to think about it a little differently.
Yeah.
And we all need to become more givers, not just takers and makers.
Yeah. I like that.
It's really important.
I like that. A couple questions left for you. I feel like every big leader has blind spots. You know, Steve Jobs is an amazing leader. Martin Luther King, amazing leaders, but they all have their own blind spots, their own weaknesses. What do you feel like some of your blind spots are, or maybe some of your weaknesses that you may have?
I tend to be a little impatient. You know, I tend to be sometimes a lot impatient. I'm not impatient as much with people as I am with motivations. You know, in other words, I do like to know why someone is how they are, why they're doing something. And then you can have a conversation about what they're doing. You know,
sure.
First, understand why. There's this great book that this guy named Simon Sinek.
I just had him on the podcast a couple weeks
ago. He's great.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that idea of start with why is a big idea.
Yeah.
And I kind of wish, you know, that I had written that book to many people, because I've always thought that way. He has the insight to write that book. It's fantastic.
Yeah.
I've circulated it all over this company.
Yeah. I was going to bring you Leaders Eat Last, but then Stuart.
I just got that.
Stuart told me you gave it away.
I gave that to everybody.
That's why I didn't bring it.
So, you know, I get very impatient with people who I feel have the wrong motivations.
Mm. Right.
If you're here for yourself, I don't want you here.
Mm.
You know, we kind of refer to it as my no shithead rule, you know, to be coarse. Can't help it. There's a certain coarseness that comes from the Bronx that I can't seem to exercise.
It's okay.
But it is true. You know, there are people, and what I mean by that is there are people who are selfish. There are people who are greedy. There are people who are obstinate and don't want to acknowledge another point of view. And those people can't work here.
Mm.
They just can't. Yeah. And I have an obligation to not allow them to. This is also a place where if you've had that in your background and you're looking to change and have a different place, then we welcome you with open arms. Come on in and be part of our tribe.
Right, right.
And because what we're trying to do is something that is a little bit different from the standard corporate motif that has emerged over the last 20 years.
Yeah.
And I'm a big believer that we have every right to do that as a company, public company or not.
Right.
Because it's allowing us to attract the right kind of people. And those people create the best kind of products and the best kind of brands and the best kind of marketing and on and on because they like what they're doing and they appreciate doing it, where they're doing it and why they're doing it.
Yeah.
And so all these things we do as a company to enhance the community and to provide educational opportunities for employees and to, you know, this facility, this campus, we have a little health club. We got a great cafeteria. We'll soon have a third of a mile jogging path over there. We got a soccer field and two basketball courts, all that. Well, why do we do that? So that you're free then to appreciate what you've got and work hard to protect it.
Yeah. Yeah. So how do you empower and inspire other people in your company or around you to step into their own greatness or become great leaders themselves for, you know, their departments or their lives, their families?
Well, what we try to do, and I don't know, this is always very difficult. Is first things first, you got to eliminate the fear component. Because the biggest step that people have to overcome is fear, right?
Mm.
Most people are afraid to try something. They're afraid of, I don't know what they're afraid of. You know, they could be afraid of the consequences. They could be afraid of failure. They could be afraid of not being seen as capable or competent. They could be afraid to make that presentation because they don't speak well.
Yeah.
Or they're afraid to speak in public. And, you know, on and on and on. We all have all these fears. And what we try to do, and I try to do it, you know, in every way I can, is to try to eliminate fear from the mix. I can't live a person's life for them. I can't get in their head.
Right.
But we try to create an environment where, you know, somebody could actually work here in a fearless way, which is better for everybody.
Yeah.
You know, so in corporate environments, the bigger they get, the more fear tends to infuse itself, and then people use fear as a control mechanism. You know, they use it as a weapon, and then fear becomes wrapped up in power. Mm. And so then power uses fear as a key element of the weapon.
Right.
And I find that to be incredibly destructive, you know. So, you know, anybody can walk into my office anytime, we can talk about anything. I walk around the business. I'm an introvert, so I tend not to, I've never been the backslapping guy.
Right.
But that doesn't mean I don't want to talk to you. I just, that's not me, you know.
Sure.
And I love that. I love it to be around people who do that. That's why they make tequila, I guess. You know? But the point is that I really feel that we can create an environment where people can be themselves. Mm. And then we can harness the collective genius of the organization that we can do anything we want.
So what's your biggest fear then?
Well, I don't have any fears, to tell you the truth. The worst thing that could ever happen to me has happened.
Yeah.
When my son passed away. I really must tell you, I don't fear anything.
Mm. Must be nice.
you arrive to this place through pain and suffering.
Sure. You've gone through a lot of fear. And
well, all the things you go through, you're still here.
Right.
So what's there to be afraid of?
Right.
I don't have any.
So what's your big vision for the rest of your life? What do you want to see in the world?
I want to see some grandkids. That'd be good.
Yeah.
I want this to be a leadership company in not just our industry, and I believe we already are in our industry, but I want it to be a leadership company that people aspire to work for and respect because of who we are, and they respect our products, you know, around the world. I don't know how big that is. It doesn't even matter how big in terms of revenue it is. But if it's a leadership company, it's well-respected, then it will create opportunities for that many more people.
Yeah.
You know, and someday I'd like to be able to do business in Cuba, which would be a wonderful thing because this absurd anachronism called the embargo is keeping 11 million people from pursuing their passions. Mm. The way that everyone else in the world should be able to do. And it exists for no apparent reason. I'll get up. That's my one political soapbox. This thing has to end. It's heart and soul destroying. Mm. And it makes us lesser as a people for continuing it. This is not American to do this to a country like that for no apparent reason anymore.
Right, right. So was that part of your vision then? That you want to be supporting
that? Yeah, I would love to make shoes in Cuba.
Yeah.
And why not?
Yeah.
You know, it's a great 90 miles off the coast. We could make footwear there. We could make it there easier than we make it in China or Vietnam or El Salvador. We make shoes in L.A. We make over a million pair of shoes in L.A.
I heard. Yeah.
You know, so we'll make shoes all over the world, but a shoe factory puts a lot of people to work, gives them self-respect, gives them pride.
Yeah.
You know, that's the first step toward, you know, leading a positive life.
Yeah. Nice. Well, final question. It's what I ask all my guests, and it's what is your definition of greatness?
Well, just being there for other people. That to me is greatness. Living a life that's other-oriented is greatness. When you arrive to that point, you can start to see some great things happening, and great things come your way, and then you get to rub greatness all over yourself. Doesn't mean you're great, but you get to rub some greatness on you.
Right.
But if you don't do that, I have a hard time seeing how greatness would ever come your way.
Right, right. Awesome. Well, I appreciate it. If there's anywhere you'd like to send people online, I know they can check out all the brands at Deckers.com. If there's anywhere else that you'd want to send them, feel free to let them know. Or if you have a Twitter, are you on the Twitter? Are you on Twitter?
I don't tweet. No. I'm not a tweeter. No. Well, no, thank you. Really appreciate it.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you guys again for joining me on today's episode. If you enjoyed this, please go head back to the show notes at lewishouse.com/124 and make sure to share this with your friends online over on Twitter and Facebook and Google+. Also tag a picture where you're listening to this episode over on Instagram at Lewis Howes over there and hashtag School of Greatness. I hope you guys enjoyed this. We had a lot of fun doing this together, and I'm very excited to Thank you guys again for all you do. We've got some other amazing interviews coming up soon, so make sure to subscribe over at itunes.com/School of Greatness. Again, thank you guys so much for joining, and thanks to Angel for sharing his wisdom of all of the success he's created over the years as the CEO of Deckers. And you guys know what time it is. It's time to go out there and do something great.